we're going to proceed to our 3 o'clock docket. The one case on our 3 o'clock docket is people, oh, 2:30 docket, sorry. Sorry. Our 2:30 docket. I'm a half hour ahead of myself. The case is People versus Upson. I hope I'm pronouncing Mr. Upson's name correctly. Counsel, have you both had an opportunity to review the procedures in this court, and are you familiar with them?
Your Honor, I have not appeared in this court, but I was an appellate lawyer for Department of Justice, and I assume they're...
All right, counsel, if you'd hold on a counsel table, I will describe those procedures quickly, and then we will proceed. And please be seated. Each side has 15 minutes. As the appellant, you can reserve as much or as little time as you like. However, it's up to you to monitor your time. The yellow light comes on at 5 minutes to advise you, but unless you ask me specifically, I won't interject a time for you. We are on the World Wide Web here after a short delay, so if there is anything that you don't want broadcast to the world, please don't say it here today. And the last thing I want to raise is that we are recording this, so please stay close to the microphone so that so that your voice will be well heard on the recording device. With that, I would finish with saying that if anyone has a pager or other device that might go off and interfere with the argument, then please turn that either to vibrate or to silent. And we shall proceed now, counsel. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. I'm Gregory Graff, attorney registration 13248. It's nice to see you. Good to see you again, Judge Plank. Your Honors, I'm sure you've read the brief, so I will try to be even briefer. A review of the record, and I was not the trial counsel in this case, Your Honor. I came in on this case sometime after sentencing, but the plea agreement in this case specifically said, and I quote, that total restitution shall be determined before sentencing. That was a specific provision of this plea agreement. The court should note that Mr. Upson was charged initially in a grand jury indictment with theft charges dealing with his business, which was referred to commonly as Verichek, which was a check authorization company that I'm sure all of your honors at some point in time have seen signs for similar type of companies where people write checks in convenience stores or at grocery stores or most frequently in gas stations, and those checks are then verified and a determination is made whether or not the check will be cashed. In this plea agreement, he was originally charged with theft, and the background of the case is probably best found in the grand jury testimony of Mr. Upson, which was attached to a subsequent brief filed by the prosecution in response to an objection to restitution. But Mr. Upson was charged with these theft charges, but I think it's important to note that when it finally came down to the plea agreement, the theft charges were dismissed and Mr. Upson was charged with a possession, given a deferred judgment and sentenced to a drug charge. The background I think that you would see in the grand jury testimony is that Mr. Upson's business eventually failed because of his drug use and his association with drug users who had basically ran his business into the ground. However, that having been said, there was clearly, by the virtue of the plea agreement itself, there was some proof problems or this would not have been the resolution to the case. Now, I say that that's something that the court can read between the lines, and I'm not saying that there's anything specific in the record, but you do have to take note of the fact that the initial charges in this case were dismissed and a deferred judgment to a drug offense was put in its stead.
Pardon me, Mr. Graff, why do we have to take a look at that considering that your client agreed to pay restitution and it was clear at least to some degree, that the restitution had to do with the Verachek business and with clients of that business?
Because, Your Honor, if there's not going to be a hearing on the issue of restitution, then the trial court needs to at least look at the evidence before it enters an order in the case without due process. Because the argument, as I see it from the prosecution side of this case, is, oh, you don't have to have a hearing. All you have to do is have some type of evidence to support the court's ruling. And in this case, if you start off with a case that is weak enough where the initial charges that would give rise to the restitution have been dismissed, and you have a plea agreement, which Mr. Upson has a right to rely on, and that plea agreement put the burden on the prosecutor to say prior to sentencing, this is the amount we seek from you, so that at a point in time where Mr. Upson is present with his counsel, has a right to confront witnesses against him, and has a right to provide evidence counter to a restitution claim, the prosecution doesn't make a claim for restitution. Instead, a month later, as the record shows, they went ahead and filed a motion for restitution, which they did not serve on Mr. Upson, and they didn't even say what the grounds were, who the victims were, or how they came up with the numbers. They just said, we're asking for restitution in this amount. This is a violation of the plea agreement. And again, that's in volume one, page two. The plea agreement specifically said this would be determined prior to sentencing. After the fact, they file a motion without any supporting documentation, without any type of rationale, and the trial court rejected that. And in fact, against my advice, Mr. Upson is the person who raised the restitution issue, because it was something that was in a plea agreement that had never been determined, and Mr. Upson is having difficulty with his probation officer during this period of time, and raised the issue 270 some odd days later, judge, you've never ruled on this issue. And at that point in time, even then, the prosecution did not submit documentation to the court until Mr. Upson twice submitted evidence to the court in the form of his pleadings and his assertions in the pleadings, indicating the facts of the case and why restitution wasn't appropriate. So what's important to note are the facts, and there is a record of the facts, because Mr. Upson eventually had a hearing in front of the collection agency board. It was a half a day hearing. They made specific factual findings using the same burden of proof, due process, and the victims themselves actually testified.
Do we know from this record that the restitution the prosecution requested was for the same people and the same amounts that were before the administrative board?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and we do now know. In fact, the prosecution moved to submit to this court the series of bond or claims to the collection agency board. They submitted that. Now, they never did submit that to the trial court. And a reading of the record, and I am trying as an officer of the court give you the most clear guidance that I can, it appears that the number that the prosecution was using was the amount of money that Mr. Upson had deposited into two bank accounts that belonged to associates of his. And the claim was made, well, since this was company money, and he was the sole owner of the company, he was basically stealing client funds. The fallacy of the argument, however, and that amount that was deposited into those two accounts is consistent with the amount claimed by the prosecution. The problem is, Your Honor, if you add up all the bond claim forms that were submitted to the collection agency board, they don't add up to the same amount. It's close, 22,000 versus 23,000. But in addition, the prosecution eventually submitted those same bond claim forms, Your Honor, along with basically what I'll refer to as a rebuttal answer to my objection to it. And they submitted the same bond claim forms. Those had been submitted to the grand jury, Your Honor. So they were in some manner presented to the trial court. The problem with those bond claim forms, Your Honor, is it doesn't take into consideration the fact that just because you're a gas station owner and somebody bounces a check to you doesn't mean the check is collectible or that it was collected. And when the collection agency board did their hearing and heard sworn testimony from all of those same bond claim forms that the prosecution had submitted to this court as a supplement, and the ones, and in fact, Your Honor, I have to also in candor to the court, the trial court did not receive all of the bond claim forms that had been grand jury indictments. There was quite a few that were missing that were submitted to Your Honor. So having been at both, having been at the bond collection agency, bond hearing, there was much more evidence presented there than had ever been presented by the prosecution in the criminal case. And what happened is the people were asked, well, was this check ever collected on? Well, no, it hadn't been. Mr. Upson's program was set up in a way where if he, with certain clients, he guaranteed checks. So the monies that had been deposited in the $23,000 or so that had been deposited, only about $2,500, and I'm using round numbers, Your Honor, but the collection agency board found that only $2,500 of that had been monies that had been collected to clients that were put in Verichek accounts and then redistributed. And even then, the collection agency board didn't say that Mr. Upson was guilty of any type of wrongdoing. The fact of the matter is that the Attorney General's office and the District Attorney's office had closed down Mr. Upson's business and also had taken control of the bank accounts, so he no longer controlled the money, but more importantly, they seized all of his computer equipment. So the $2,500 or so that had been client money, and I equate this to it like a lawyer's trust account. Some of this money, $2,500 of it, should have remained in trust for the clients, and he had taken that out of the business and put it into a personal account of a friend. Basically, his position was to protect it from the other drug-associated individuals who had been basically robing the company.
Now let me, I may jump ahead a little bit in your argument here, Mr. Kraft, but let's assume for purposes of argument that we reject the Attorney General's argument that that we should affirm this straight out, and that there's significant enough problem that we should remand for a hearing. Will that satisfy you?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because from the get-go, and had I been on this case initially, I would have raised that issue first time up. There was a plea agreement, and the plea agreement said this will be determined before sentencing, and the prosecution never presented one iota of evidence to the trial court prior to sentencing. They did it 30 days or roughly 27 days later and didn't even inform the defendant, and the trial court rejected that. The prosecution never submitted a request for restitution that met any type of due process standard. In fact, even to today, they never have, Your Honor, because nowhere in their request for restitution do they say, this is the victim, this is why the money is owed. They simply came up with a number. That number corresponds to money that Mr. Upson deposited into two accounts, which the board has already found was Mr. Upson's money. He had already paid the clients money for the check amounts. It's important to know a little bit about how the money is made by these places. He guarantees the check. If you bounce a check, I'm not saying Your Honor would bounce a check, but if you did and it was for $10, Mr. Upson then pays the gas station $10. Now he goes ahead and relying on the statute, makes a demand on the person who bounced the check, and he's entitled to statutory fees. And if they don't pay the first time, there's another statutory fee, and then on top of that, if he files a lawsuit, he's entitled to the costs of the action as well, and including attorney's fees. And so to the extent that he has attorneys on his staff working for them, there's money to be made there as well, and that's how they make the money. These claims that were made were by people who did not have the money that was deposited into Mr. Upson's, the private accounts, was Mr. Upson's money for a client that had already been paid, and he had made collections, and that was his money, with the exception of about $2,500, which has already been paid back. And in fact, the evidence at the board hearing, Your Honor, was that to the extent Mr. Upson had some client money and knew who the clients were, despite the fact that the prosecution had all of the records and would not release them to Mr. Upson, he had made some refunds from his own funds, so he was trying to do the right thing. And there was $2,500, which was not available because he didn't know who to give it to. And then at the board hearing, they entered the order and he was bonded. And this is why the court should not remand it. Mr. Upson entered into this agreement thinking that he would know the dollar amount at sentencing. Prosecution did not ask for that amount. Then he goes to a board hearing where he's bonded. He's insured. If these people did not get paid and they were entitled to it, he would not have had to pay this money himself. He was bonded. So what happens, he goes in there, the prosecution has presented as evidence to the trial court in the submission of these grand jury exhibits, which were the same bond claim forms that were before the board, who was doing an evidentiary hearing, and that board then finds, because Mr. Upson then, in reliance on the plea agreement, goes and defends, and instead of sitting there and saying, well, I've got a judgment from the trial court saying I owe $23,000 in restitution, and going into the bond hearing saying, I confess $23,000 in debt is owed to this list of people, and then being bonded, he goes in and defends, wins, $2,500 is paid by the bondsman, and then after the fact, the court then issues a restitution order in which now Mr. Upson isn't bonded anymore. So in detrimental reliance on the plea agreement, he has suffered and will never be made whole.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I'm Christine Brady, registration number 24779, representing the people. In regard to the language of the plea agreement, the plea agreement itself says that the amount of restitution is to be determined. The stipulation for the deferred judgment also says in handwriting, filling in a blank, the restitution is to be determined. Although we had that ambiguous sentence in the written, a typed ambiguous sentence in the written plea agreement, that handwritten notation, to be determined on the stipulation, certainly shows that they reserved restitution. This all happened on the same day. So it doesn't make sense to say that the defendant entered into an agreement where restitution was going to be determined before sentencing. The plea and the sentencing was all on the same day. And of course, we don't have a transcript. The defendant did not provide the transcript of that disposition sentencing hearing. So in that case, this court must presume that restitution was reserved. And in addition, the party's actions that we have on the record reinforces the fact that restitution was reserved. Once the trial court, trial court issued its sentence, and then less than a month later, the prosecution filed a motion for restitution. And when the defendant objected immediately, they didn't object on the grounds of the plea agreement. They objected on the grounds of, well, this is, we don't think we owe this amount, which is basically a proximate cause objection. So there was a timely request here. There was a request by the district attorney within the 90-day period, and then the defense counsel filed a motion objecting on proximate cause grounds. Then the trial court ordered the parties to confer and come up with a figure. Then nothing happens until 9 months later, when apparently the defendant hired counsel to handle the bond hearing. This is basically on the eve of the bond hearing, just a few weeks before. So all of these facts put together tell us from the record that restitution was properly reserved and that there was no promise by the district attorney that restitution would be resolved before the bond hearing. In regard to the defendant's argument about the evidentiary hearing, in general, it's the trial court's discretion to order a hearing or not. If the trial court finds that the documents and arguments submitted by the prosecution is sufficient, then no hearing is okay. The defendant relies on the Martinez case. The facts are distinguishable there because in that case, the trial court had already determined that a hearing was necessary, had scheduled the hearing on the docket, and only the defense counsel showed up. So the Martinez case does not stand for the proposition that there always must be a hearing. Here, the trial court found that there was proximate cause based on the district attorney's motion and attachments. And this is where the record becomes a little bit unclear. And the people do admit that the record is unclear. The calculations that the prosecution made are clearly based on the bond claim forms. The defendant even admits that in his brief on page 5. What we don't know is why the bond claim forms were not made part of the record. The defense had them. The prosecution had them. We don't know if the trial court himself ever looked at the bond claim forms. But we do know that the calculations were made from the bond claim forms. There's a $271.65 difference. So that's problematic, and it's hard to review this case without specific findings from the trial court about how it arrived at that figure. It is obvious that it accepted the prosecution's argument, the motion, the arguments in the motion and the attachments. We don't know if the bond claim forms were attached. We know that the transcript from the grand jury hearing was attached, and that is also in the record. We know that the grand jury hearing included the bond claim forms. Those were attached as exhibits during the grand jury hearing. We don't know why they weren't made part of the record, and that's a reason why a remand would be very helpful in this case. What we cannot do is just vacate the restitution order just because we don't have enough information to review the trial court's findings. Well, there aren't any findings. Basically, the trial court found there was proximate cause, and I think the statement was based on the prosecution's motion and attachments. But to just vacate a restitution order when the trial court has found proximate cause would result in an illegal sentence. There's only a few things the trial court can do. It can order restitution, or it can order that there is no restitution. No restitution is owed. So the answer is not to vacate the restitution order.
Now, pardon me, counsel. Do we know whether the trial court made any analysis of whether Mr. Upson was entitled to an offset based on the findings of the administrative hearing?
From the record that we have, the trial court apparently did not make any analysis in that regard. If it did make an analysis, it is not part of the record. It basically wrote, I forgot if it was a stamp or a right, wrote denied on that. So that is another finding that we're missing here. Why didn't the trial court, what is the basis of the trial court denying the motion for offset? And I would just like to clarify something from in the defendant's brief. He states that the grand jury testimony says that most of the client's money had already been paid to them, so that the $25,500 he deposited in personal accounts instead of his necessary escrow account that he's required to have under the collection agency statutes, he claimed that most of that money belonged to him. However, the grand jury rejected that, obviously, because they indicted him for theft. And there was a factual basis for the plea. We know that. We don't have the transcript from the plea hearing, so we must presume that there was a factual basis for the theft. In regard to proximate cause, the defendant argued today that there was no proximate cause because the DA seized all the checks. Well, the theft was completed before the district attorney got involved. The grand jury indicted him for theft of over $15,000. So it found evidence that there was more than just $2,000 as a result of the theft, which is something distinct from the surety bond. And again, whether proximate cause is established, that's completely different and separate from whether we have an adequate record to review. And then just a last point about the surety bond. The agency hearing is a separate proceeding. It has nothing to do with the criminal proceeding. Yes, it is the preponderance of the evidence standard. But we don't know what their requirements are and how that differs from a proceeding for theft. And one thing that seems to be apparent from the record is that live testimony is required in order for a surety to pay on the bond. And it's possible here that only $2,000 was ordered because maybe the other witnesses didn't show up. This is different from any sentencing hearing, and certainly for restitution, where a victim impact statement alone is enough to order restitution. And here the defendant had ample opportunity to attack anything that was in the bond claim forms because he had those forms. There are no further questions. The people ask that this court affirm or remand for findings. Thank you.
We have no further questions. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. This, we now reach the end of our hearings for today. And if the bailiff would announce the recess, please.
Recess, subject to call.